ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time is here. That's right, we are still talking Friday the 13th, part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan-ish Parts of Canada on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal Patrick Hamilton coming to you once again from the river that's attached to Camp Crystal Lake. According to some nautical people in this movie, this is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. We will be unpacking all the gory details of Friday the 13th Part 8 in the hopes that a Lakeview High's graduate's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make about them. And of course, there is only one person I trust to threaten a menacing deckhand with a flare gun, the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing, Gina?
I'm good. I'm glad to be back from my unintentional sabbatical.
We miss you dearly, although in terms of how people actually consume the podcast, you were back for Terror Train, so you have reemerged. This is your time to re-enter the world of Friday the 13th, at least.
I am glad to be back in that world. Should I try that again? Should I bring a little more enthusiasm, a little more juice to it?
No, I enjoy the honesty, to be honest. To be honest with you, not to put too fine a point on it. I mean, I'm hot and cold on this. This movie is terrible in a lot of ways, but it's also a lot of fun to talk about. I sure hope it's fun for people to listen to, I guess.
If they don't have to watch it, sure.
Absolutely. Well, Gina, I don't want to alarm you, but we are not alone. No, our guest this week knows all about a good Siege-style horror film because he wrote one. That's right. You might know him from the recent release Jackals, the one and only Jared Rivette. How you doing,
Hello.
Sir?
I am doing great. I am so proud to be joining you on this long voyage from New Jersey to Manhattan.
You really have to secure yourself.
That arduous trek.
I mean, so many people died creating this route. Really, we should be honoring their sacrifice rather than, you know, nitpicking at the idea that Crystal Lake is connected to a river that's big enough for a boat to go on it that also connects to New York Harbor.
After a long, long voyage.
Oh, my God.
Many hours.
At one point, they do stop. Oh. Because when our main character, Rennie, is unceremoniously bumped off the boat, it's not moving at all. That's just right. Fucking stop for no particular reason. It's time for us to stop here. Now, we have a tradition here on the Kill by Kill podcast, Jared, and that is that we want to know what your first introduction was to the Friday the 13th film series.
It was definitely more of an awareness thing. I was young in the 1970s. I was around, but I was not old enough to go see R-rated movies. But my memory of it was waiting in line to see The Empire Strikes Back, and the poster for Friday the 13th was on the wall, and being completely intrigued and drawn to that whole, you know, what is that and how creepy is it and how scared would I be? And then I did not see it in the theater. I saw it on cable, and young Jason popping up out of the lake at the end pretty much did me in, terrified me. And I, from that point on, would kind of consume any and every Friday the 13th movie that I could on cable. And the first one I saw theatrically was Final Chapter.
It took me a while. I think this might, this or part 7 might have been my first one in the theater. My family had a more strict control over my viewing habits, unlike Gina, who was in some sort of New Jersey-based Wild West.
Yeah, I basically just lived among the wolves. I was allowed to watch whatever I wanted.
Totally. Totally. Same here.
And all for our benefit.
Exactly.
When you think about it.
Exactly.
So here we are in the midst of Friday the 13th Part 8. We rejoin the action right around the point where it appears like Jason has pegged another grown man with a spear. Turns out, no, he's actually placed it in his lower back. The director's just framed it in a very super weird way. Mm-hmm. Followed up by Captain I'm Disappointed in You, Dad, getting his throat
sliced with the wrong way of the machete, as per Friday the 13th tradition.
And a very bloodless wound at that.
And it's very oddly edited. Not only is the throat slicing slowed down, but then the cutaway shot to the window is slowed down.
They're trying for a couple little artsy things here. Like, certainly with that, and we'll get to it when with Eva's death scene. They're trying a little something and seeing if anything, actually works, and you know, surprise, it doesn't really work. But
yeah, I think there was some directorial, you know, wheel reinvention going on in the creative end of this movie. I think it's his first feature. He had done, Rob Hedden had done episodes of Friday the 13th, the series, prior to this, and this was when 7 and 8 are pretty much being run by the folks that were doing the series, right? That was kind of the Canadian connection.
Yeah, they're all kind of mixing and matching together at that point. I'm sure it was a lot. I mean, this is sort of a heyday of people doing a lot of TV up in Canada.
Not that it's really stopped, but he's
I don't know that he's the best match stylistically. There's a lot of choices here that seem to push everything in a supernatural direction without giving it any sort of rules.
No.
And it becomes very confusing as a result.
Absolutely.
So here we go. We now find ourselves with Sean and Rennie. Rennie has managed to change her clothes, but Sean is still wearing the same clothes that he jumped into the ocean or a river or a lake, we're not sure which, to rescue her, and immediately told, go get me some towels, because he hasn't done enough. They are investigating some odd happenings on the ship now. They're convinced that something weird is going on. Rennie wants to get off, and she asks, before we get into that, let's do a quick body count. Let's tell everyone who is still alive at this point in the movie. First up, we have Rennie. This is our lead character. She looks like Wendy's mascot attending a very chilly stop of the Lilith Fair tour. And then we have Sean, who is Rennie's boyfriend. Maybe. I mean, the sexual chemistry between this two, I would rate on a score from 0 to Cobb salad.
Well, is the zero Wayne and JJ?
Well, I want Wayne and JJ to have sexual chemistry. They just don't happen to have anything. Wayne is blind. I don't know how you could walk into a room and JJ is available to talk to in any way, shape, or form, and you go, oh, no. Let me go off and try to pursue this, you know, crazy cokehead who can't finish a biology report before she graduates.
Right. Well, and let's not forget what the 10 is, which is Tamara and McCulloch. I mean, they're definitely like, that's hot teacher-student action.
There's so much awkward leg movement in that. And up until this point, I thought it was all behind me, but all it takes is one person mentioning it, and it just leaps to mind. Speaking of which, we have Charles, who is Rennie's legal guardian and the worst decision maker who has ever lived. God. If he told you that the moon was up, I'm pretty sure it would be noon. Like, he doesn't make a right decision in this entire movie.
No, and
it is laughable that he's a school official in any way, shape, or form.
And his decision make his commentary is just, he goes straight to asshole every single time.
He watched Animal House and thought Dean Wormser was the hero.
Right. There is a point later in the movie than where we are, where they dock the lifeboat at the docks, and McCulloch actually says to Sean, great place to dock a boat.
Well, yeah.
It's a dock.
Where would you like him to dock it? 42nd Street?
I have absolutely no idea. I have no idea what the point of that line was. It's incredible. It's just asshole. It's just pure asshole.
It's like they all sat around between takes and like, what's the worst thing he could possibly say? And whatever grip came up with the right line, that's what got put on his pages for the day. Continuing along with our body count, we have Colleen. Now, Colleen is Rennie's teacher at school, and she's a woman that's so upset by how Charles constantly rules Rennie's life and makes all her decisions for her that she's going to do something about it. She's going to tell Rennie how to live her life and what to do at all times instead. That'll teach her. And we also have Julius, who is an undefeated high school boxer, which may be the most fantastical description inside of this movie that also features Jason Voorhees captaining a boat. And that pretty much leaves us with the characters that their lives will memorialize on today. And so, once again, let's snap back to Sean and Rennie. Rennie wants to get off the boat, and Sean says, I'm going to radio for a Coast Guard clipper. They'll come pick you up. And then she's like, but you're not going to come? Now, this is before they walk into the captain's cabin.
What is the bridge.
Fucking name it? The wheelhouse. The bridge!
You need more Star Trek. You have to go to another Paramount franchise to learn your nomenclature.
Yes, absolutely right. And this is where we get our first glimpse of something we don't actually see a whole lot in this movie, but we've seen many, many times before. And that is Jason Voorhees, interior / exterior decorator. He's placed the captain's body just so that it only falls once eyeballs are placed on it.
Yeah, the timing of it is just, it's Rube Goldbergian. It's really, it's just, it's astonishing. It's like an OK Go video.
Well, and think about it. I mean, think about, he had to actually think about the currents and waves and tides and the moon in order to make that happen, because the boat is swaying. There's a big storm going on.
Well, he was able to correctly and immediately identify the wires that attach the communication system for the ship.
And later he'll do something with a fire alarm that we need to talk about.
This movie ascribes certain knowledge to Jason Voorhees, a mutant backwoods killer, possibly raised by raccoons and a single working toilet. With fantastical abilities. Now, we've denoted in the past how he magically learned how to swim, which, for a kid who drowned, that's saying something. That's true. But now he knows all the ins and outs of a boat's mechanics. It's like last time I ascribed it to him having a sort of sexual awakening. Now, we've always talked about how Jason knows your fuck style and uses it against you. But now he's actually employing his own fuck style. He's killed two people on a boat. Now he's killed several people on a boat. And that's all Jason wants to do for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. It's like, I love how my legs go back and forth, and I stab people. He's into it.
It's relaxing. And it's, I mean, like, when you ever have one of those, do you ever use one of, like, white noise apps? Like, half of them have to do with water sounds.
That's right. He has. He's totally found his calling.
And it only took him 7 films to get there, but we finally found, put your notebooks down, bloggers. We found the best Jason. Not the best Jason to watch, but the best Jason for Jason.
We found we found the Yacht Rock Jason. He's gonna be chilling with a wine spritzer, some Boss Skaggs on the radio, just coasting right into Manhattan.
That's right. We got some East Coast yacht going on. Let the Yacht Rock, Beyond Yacht Rock guys know we finally found a correct mascot for their podcast. After they've had Yacht Rock, a genre they literally created from nothing, ripped out of their hands over and over and over again in the last 2 years. Now, the look on Sean's face when he discovers Captain Dad is something to be believed, because this is either the best or the worst moment of his life. Because while he's found his only father, his throat slashed, he's also free of his hatred of how he doesn't do the right things when you're launching a boat.
Mm, it's true.
He's kind of in amazement, but he's also, there's a twinkle in his eyes. At the same time, Rennie doesn't know what to make of it. There's a lot of Star Trek acting as they brace themselves over various waves that do not look to be occurring. And this is when Sean announces to everyone, there's been a terrible incident. Everyone come to the place where the incident happened.
And everyone's like, yeah, all right, sure.
Well, Julius is like, what the fuck is this? And is immediately surrounded by toadies who are like, yeah, I don't know what the fuck this is. Every room Julius walks into, he's surrounded by white guys who are like, he's in charge. And there's a reason, because Julius is one of those, the rare breed of Friday the 13th characters. When presented with the idea that a masked madman is cutting down young people left and right, he's like, well, we ought to fucking do something about it. Where have you been all my life, Julius?
Not on my watch, baby. Not on my graduation cruise. I sold magazine subscriptions for 6 months to pay for this fucking thing.
everyone with the I know Wayne is there too. So everyone who's on the first sheet of the call sheet is called into this room who's left alive.
Pretty much. Although there's a couple of randos later on that are left in the restaurant, and I don't know where they are in this
scene. Yeah. Well, now that is a source of great debate, because earlier this week, you know, it was Halloween. By the time this airs, it'll be 2 weeks after. But everyone attempts to start writing horror articles, even though they have a very tangential idea of, you know, what horror movies are, or they've watched them once. They've done some internet research and they think they're super smart. And someone noted in their list of 9 things you don't know about Friday the 13th that this has the highest body count. And they're counting people who were killed in the boat explosion. Now, are we counting people caught in a boat explosion? Because Jason did not intend for the boat to sink.
Would he really care, though? Point. Would he be like, oh, no, gee, guys, I didn't mean that. I'm sorry.
I don't know that he cares, but I don't know that he would count those bodies. I don't know. He'd go, oh, I got some people in the periphery. Good for me. Who killed a bunch of extra people and he wasn't even trying? The guy between these two thumbs.
I mean, I guess it. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten into debates about this with other movies. Alien 3, I've had the same argument about who kills Bishop. There was this whole thing that went around involving how, you know, Bill Paxton was killed by a Predator, a Terminator, and the Alien. And there was this, when Paxton died, for some reason, that started floating around again. But then everybody was adding that Lance Henriksen has also been killed by all three of those critters. And I was arguing that in Alien 3, he is not killed by the alien. He is killed by Ripley. And I had people tell me, well, the alien is responsible for the crash that put him, or if you want to count the queen, that tore him in half. So I have this question, I guess, about whether or not we're counting. I mean, the people that die on the boat later on die because of the sinking of the boat, which is caused by Jason.
Yeah.
It's a debate.
But unintentionally, it's not like he knew.
No.
You know, Gina already mentioned this. He knows that those wires on that antenna, which doesn't really look like any other antenna, are going to cut it off. Yeah. Does he know when he throws Wayne's body on top of that electrical panel, which is something he just likes to do in general?
Of course.
This is like the third time he's thrown somebody on an electrical panel and he's like, whoopsie, he pulls a Steven Seagal act usually on them. But this time it's a full on hoi.
Now, mind you, he pulls the wires out. Now, he's been in that bridge and he could have very easily simply destroyed the radio. It wouldn't have been all that difficult, especially if he's right there and it's a source of communication. Just break that fucking thing. But instead, he waits until Sean is making the distress call and then decides to pull the wires out on camera. We watch him do it.
It's true. He waited for the camera crew to show up. Well, he's given ample opportunity because Sean makes the longest call for help I've ever seen in my life. He starts celebrating in the middle of it, which maybe his dad was right. Maybe he's not ready to captain a ship. I don't know. He went very downhill in terms of trustworthiness from where he was way high before. This is a maneuver that I find troubling, that he starts this call with the Coast Guard and then pauses to go, yes, I did it. And that's when Jason cuts the wires and now you haven't done it. Well, thanks a lot, Sean. Fucking, why did we give you that sexton? God damn it.
Nowadays, you've got all this fancy electronic equipment that tells you exactly how to do it without having to have any real problem. But here's a clunky mechanical thing from the 1700s that you can use instead.
But no. When we're talking about bad maneuvers, there's only one person in this pile of people that, well, I wouldn't say rises, sinks to the bottom low enough that you always know where he is. And that's Charles. He runs in the room yelling, I demand to know what's going on, which I don't think he needs to say. I think that's implied every time he enters any room.
I think it would have been much funnier if he just like tripped over the captain's body, like on his way to like just blustering into the room.
I mean, he's so full of bluster that even after nearly tripping over that body, he puts his hand on Sean's back and says, doesn't say sorry. He can't bring himself to say, I'm sorry. We got one of these people in charge, and one of these people is in a time capsule in this Friday the 13th movie. They can't stop shooting themselves in the dick. It's insane because they have tiny dicks.
Yeah, he's basically makes Ed Rooney look like Mr. Chips. I mean, honestly.
I often wonder, with his lines, like we talked about the doc thing, I wonder if he just kind of had all of his lines memorized, and when he arrived on the set, he just said, you cannot change any of these lines.
Yeah.
I know these lines. And sir, we've now established in this particular set that it's different than when it was written, and we're going to have... No, you don't understand. I have memorized all of the lines. This is the way that they will be recited. Because he really does. He walks in a room, and sometimes he says things that everyone else already sees, or that aren't the way that he says they are, or, you know, great place to dock a boat, or whatever it is, where he just kind of looks at the situation, and it's like, well, wait, wouldn't you see that? Wouldn't you... Like, why do you have to say these things out loud? You're right. It is a completely obvious scene to walk in on, and then he has to demand to know what's going on as though that isn't empirically clear from walking in the room.
Well, now, yeah. you're probably the person that we would ask about this, because you are a legitimate screenwriter. So, have you, not naming names, of course, but have you run into, in your vast career at this point,
the one produced movie?
Well, you are a working screenwriter. You don't earn money as a barista and then you got one movie made.
Like, that's correct.
So I'm a writer. Not everything I do is produced. I'm paid to put words on a page. So have you run into a situation, either personally or through your colleagues, where someone has decided the text that you have given me is sacrosanct and I'm going to say it no matter what, and no matter what seems to constantly be happening?
Yes, I definitely have. I've had both ways. I've had the, I'm going to say exactly what you wrote, and everybody in the room kind of feeling like, maybe he doesn't need to, you know, now that we're here and I see how this is being staged, no, you don't necessarily need to say that. Mm-hmm. And then I've also had, hey, I'm just going to change this line. I had an actor who will remain nameless who wanted to change the age of another character by changing the line of dialogue. And it was something that had already been established in an earlier scene in the movie. And he or she just did not feel that that age suited the person whom he was speaking to.
Okay.
And decided to say, you know, that here's how old you are. And so we had like an ugly, weird little moment where we had to kind of firmly put our foot down and say, no, you have to say this. So I've had both. And it is interesting. And I have, of course, stepped in and said, hey, look, like, you don't now have to say, hey, I demand to know what's going on, because, look, there's dead bodies on the floor and everyone's kind of gathered to try to figure out what to do. Like, you don't necessarily have to state the obvious when you've walked in the room. So, yeah, sometimes you just feel it out. And sometimes actors will impulsively just say, like, hey, you know, look, no offense, but I'm not going to say this because I don't. Do you agree with me that this is now obvious? And you say, yes, absolutely. Just cut that line.
Yeah. Because you're making the film three times. One is on, you know, your computer, the next time when you're on set, the next time when you're in the editing booth. So each time you're sort of, you know, amassing a clock with all these moving pieces that must move in synchronous manner three separate times. It's a really hard thing to put together. So we understand why things fall apart. Oh, God, it's so interesting. Okay. So in the midst of this meeting of the minds, let's say, in walks Crazy Ralph Maritime Edition yet again. He is my least favorite harbinger, because he didn't warn anyone before they got onto the ship, and he hasn't come up with anything to say other than you're just generally duped. Like, Crazy Ralph had two purposes. One, perv on people through windows. That's always number one. It's always at the top of the list. Number two, have very good posture when you're riding a bike. And three, warn people away from the area where murder's about to happen. And he's very successful in the first two. That third one, his record's a little shoddy, but that's because people don't believe him or don't listen to him. Here, it doesn't matter if you believe or listen to him. They're all trapped on the same fucking boat he is, and he didn't get off.
Yeah, he missed a couple classes in Harbinger of Doom School.
That's true. Ralph just, you know, he pedaled away.
Yeah, I mean, yes. he missed, you know, tell people in advance. He missed, please remove yourself from immediate danger. He missed all the key aspects of Doom Harbingering.
I mean, he's the worst of the the crazy Ralph sequels, for sure. He's right at the bottom. He's also the one who mentions that he saw Jason get off a boat, which again confirms that he saw Jason piloting a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Which I just, every time I think about it, cannot stop laughing at the very idea of it. Secondly, he says, I saw him get on down the river, which now means that this lake is attached to a river, which is attached to the ocean, which is attached to New York Harbor. So, and surrounded by mountains that have never been there before. But hey, that's Canada for you. What are you going to fucking do? Yeah, Charles McCullough is just the worst fucking official.
He is.
And I will say this. He does one thing right. When he asks Sean, have you seen the person who I'm supposedly in charge of, who doesn't like to listen to me and I give her bad advice all the time? He's like, oh yeah, I sent that girl who's afraid of water and never been on a boat for like a decade to go drop anchor in the middle of a storm. And he's like...
And she knows exactly where to go. She knows exactly what lever to push. It's
mm-hmm. That's right. She goes to a lever that does not appear to be labeled.
She's like taking like 2 years of boating school, just you know, looking around her. Yep, that's the one. Clank.
Right. For a cruise ship to stop a cruise ship dead in its tracks.
In its tracks, and she just cranks it up, and wheels start turning, and we assume that to be an anchor. But it also looks like the chain is going up.
Who knows?
Who knows? Who's to say? There's not a lot of great detail work. We got a killer POV shot coming up on her where the person looks at an axe and then to her, which when we find out it's Charles, I'm beginning to think he's like, ooh, just one swing, Charles. They'd never know.
They'll blame it on the other guy.
It's the perfect plan. No one's around. I can kill her. I can keep my sweater vest clean. And we're good to go. Oh, man. I understand the implication here. You want to fake the audience out.
Yes.
But when you find out that it's Charles, that makes zero goddamn sense.
No, absolutely. No, it's a goofy, 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 goofy movie.
not the goofy movie, just a goofy movie.
No. Just a goofy, 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 goofy movie. And I would also like to add that the Harbinger is, I've never pronounced his name before, but it's Alex Diakon or Dakin. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but he's one of those guys. As soon as you see him, whether it's been in an interior or not, as soon as you see him in a movie or a TV show, you know that you're in Canada.
He's legally mandated to appear.
He's total a Canadian character actor. He played multiple character roles in X-Files, and he would just in anything that's shot in Canada, he is cast.
He must be a wonderful person to be on set with.
Oh, I'm sure he's got amazing friggin' stories. But yeah, he's one of those guys where I see him and I'm like, oh, shot in Canada. It's like the dead giveaway of whatever it is I'm watching.
So we're about to meet our first of the people that we're going to memorialize on this particular episode. Their deaths are very brief, but they are important. And that first person is Eva, and you will know her because she will never be caught with her pants down. The reason? She's wearing a belt and suspenders.
She's wearing suspenders backwards.
She's not another bad little fad. She's crisscross.
That's right.
Like the Mac Daddy and the Daddy Mac.
with the references almost as old as this movie.
Almost, but this predates it. So I wonder if someone in Atlanta saw this. It's like, oh, it looks terrible on her, but I'm a 12-year-old boy. That would look so much better. You're right. You know, for like that one summer, you were totally right.
I would also like to point out in the scene that she appears in the chunk of the movie that we are discussing, there is more slime, snot, and there's something that is recurring throughout Jason Takes Manhattan is that Jason is covered in this viscous snot.
Yeah, when she's looking at the hole he made in the door, it looked like a scene out of Aliens. It's just like this is something just oozing from it.
And I don't know what that is. And ghost child Jason, who, by the way, why is he dead and a ghost? Who knows? He's right there. But he's also covered in the stuff. And it looks like it's cold. Like it looks like it's making him shiver. But I don't know why. I don't know what. I mean, I had read up a little bit on this, and Hodder said that he was sliding around all over the place. Like when there were all these flubs and bloopers where he was just sliding around because he was covered in this shit. And I guess
there's a shot coming up where he steps when he goes up to Wayne, uh-huh. He plants his left foot and it slides out from beneath.
Yeah. No, I think and so evidently what the thinking was that he was covered in kind of bottom of Crystal Lake silt or slime, just the, you know, stuff from being at the bottom of a lake for all these years. But yeah. He is constantly oozing snot. At one point the snot comes out of his eye socket.
And he's still just thumping and squishing away whenever he walks around too.
No, and that's yeah. So I don't know what the thinking. Yet another one of the reinventing the wheel type things. Like Jason's never been covered in slime before, but in this movie he is manufacturing slime at every step.
It's one of those crazy things where someone, you know, and listen, every single movie here. I know by this point they figured, okay, this is a series. The train just keeps on rolling.
Right.
But one of the fascinating parts of doing this and looking at these movies in such detail is that you see how most of the filmmakers said, I'm going to paint, if this ever happens again, I'm painting that guy into a corner.
Right.
Like, I got forced into a weird corner. I'm going to paint you into a corner.
Exactly.
And the fun is, how are you going to get out of it? And some people obviously do a lot better at it than others. But this particular director has decided that he's going to reinvent Jason Voorhees in the 8th movie.
Yes.
Which takes some balls. And so, yeah, we have this simultaneous Jason thing where he's a ghost and, like all cinematic ghosts, won't tell you what the fuck he wants. And... you also have the lumbering giant who's constantly sloughing off whatever the fuck he's emanating. And he's also breathing a lot.
Heavily.
Like he's Darth fucking Vader. Why does this reanimated zombie need to breathe is my question to the panel.
I mean, when Eva runs into him in the hallway right after she finds Tamara's body, he's heaving. Like, and what has he been doing? He hasn't been doing anything.
He's like he's been helping his friends move.
You know, or he decided today to take the stairs up to the office. Never doing that again.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Oh my God. They told me to take it easy on the treadmill when I got back. I mean, honestly, I overdid it a little bit.
gotta lay off those Newports, man. Shit.
He's so exhausted and he's so winded that he decides to teleport for the rest of the scene.
My wife got me a coupon for this rowing class. And they said it was going to be easy for all levels, but I'm just having some trouble. Okay. Did I ever tell the mixed martial arts story on the podcast?
No, I would have definitely remembered that one.
So at one point, Becky and I decided, fuck TV, we're going to write a book. And then we wrote a book and they said, this is too funny to put in print. No one reads funny mysteries. And it was all over with. So as part of that, one of the main characters, you know, knew how to fight. And of course, I don't know deck about fighting. So she got me this trial set of classes for mixed martial arts. And I come in and we start warming up and kicking and punching and this, this, and then we're doing jumping jacks, and then we're doing jumping rope. And I'm like, oh my God, we're like 45 minutes into this. And I'm surprised I'm standing upright. He goes, all right, that's a great warm up. What the fuck are you talking about? And we proceeded to go for another 45 minutes. And wow. I am doing everything I can. I'm taking in water. I'm not pushing. He says, don't push yourself. I'm like, I'm just trying to stay upright. And towards the end of it, I had an idea that if I didn't sit down right that very minute, I'm not sure I could control my bladder. There wasn't anything in my bladder because all the moisture in my body was coming out through every other pore. But
like Jason's not.
Pretty much. Just every, like, I was soaking, like I had jumped in a pool fully clothed, and I'm like, I can't believe this, that I can't even really hold on to whatever minuscule amount of pee I have in my bladder. And it's like, you're the only guy who's gotten through this class in the last 6 months who hasn't passed out.
Wow.
That's something you tell somebody when they walk in the door. You don't wait until after where it was like, congratulations on not fainting. No.
Yeah.
He gave me an apple as a reward. Oh my God. I ate that apple for 45 minutes.
As they're rolling you out of the classroom in a stretcher with an oxygen mask over your face.
Not convinced that I was going to make it back to my car, which I had not paid for parking for that long, and I'm like, oh my God, are we gonna get a ticket?
At least on roller coasters, they put that warning up, you know, right? You've been waiting in line for an hour and 15 minutes, and then there's a sign that says, oh, by the way, if you're pregnant or have a heart condition, you probably shouldn't. Or if you're too short, you probably shouldn't drive. But no, let's do this incredibly rigorous thing to you that your body can't handle and that you have no coordinates for, and we'll do it to you. And then we'll tell you, by the way, that people die when they're doing this.
So yeah, poor Jason is really put out. I mean, maybe the teleportation thing is stressful. It seems like it would be easier.
Maybe that's what it is.
You know, just willing your body to go from one end of a short disco / snack bar to the other.
Right.
Seems like that would be easier than actual moving and stomping around.
It's
but
very
yeah,
true.
His breathing belies that notion.
It's very true. And yeah, so the teleport Jason is not born in this scene. He's actually born in the scene with JJ. What's the that's where the first instance of teleportation, teleport Jason actually appears. But this is the weirdest one. I mean, this is incredibly strange. This whole bit where she's standing in the middle of an empty dance floor and can't get away from Jason.
I feel like, like I said earlier, that they're trying a couple different things, and I feel like this is supposed to be sort of a weird giallo sort of thing where he's everywhere and then he's nowhere and then, oh no, he's right there in front of you and it's too late. And
he's not just everywhere and nowhere. At one point he is in two places at once.
Yes, they look at each other. Yes. Like, oh, the fuck, you can see me?
Yes.
Yeah, I see you.
Yes.
You have a hockey mask on.
Yes.
And this would be much more effective is that the room wasn't lit like a wedding reception in a VFW hall. I don't know how she has so much trouble keeping track of where he is, because there's not a single shadow in the entire room. There is no place for him to hide.
She either has no peripheral vision or just no aware, or her bangs, her hair is just keeping her from being able to see things to the side, because you don't really actually have to turn more than 45 degrees to see where he is next.
Well, and then don't forget that she is looking dead at him when he grabs her.
Yes.
She is looking straight into his face. I mean, he is right in front of her when he leaps into frame and grabs her by the neck. So, I mean, it's not even about just the bangs or the peripheral vision or the suspenders blocking her ability to see. It's that he is just appearing out of nowhere, and it makes zero sense. And it's the first time in the entire series that he's had this ability. And I should add, I found out today, I'm not a gamer, I'm not a video game guy, but I have recently learned in doing research for this podcast, because that's the kind of guy that I am, that the video game has incorporated the teleportation as like a, either like a finishing move or a special, you mash certain buttons together and you get to teleport, but it is an in-joke from Jason in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen baby steps towards this before. And I think it sort of starts in part two. That third act plays a wonderful magic trick on people. There's a couple incidents where the camera will veer left and then veer back right. And you think Jason, who you last saw on the left, will be coming that way, and then he comes on the right. So, but that's explainable. Like, the killer he is in that movie is someone who can sneak around on you. He's a stalker. He then becomes a lumbering mutant after that, who in part four can go up and down the both stories of a single house in a snap.
Yes, without anybody noticing, without any of the occupants of the house noticing. Yes.
And no one smells him.
No.
Which is something
I've totally talked about that. It's one of my complaints, and I've worked with Marcus Nispel on a couple of different projects, neither of which came to fruition. Over the years, we've worked on a couple of different things, and I've never had this discussion with him. But the thing about Friday 2009 is this kind of recurring move that Jason makes, where he's standing behind people that don't realize he's standing behind them. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, A, that was never Jason's thing. Like, I don't know why they do it like four times in that movie, where the camera pans over and then suddenly he's standing right behind somebody. But wouldn't you smell him? Like, in that movie especially, they establish, like, in this one, okay, he's been in the ocean and it's raining. Maybe he doesn't stink anymore. You know, maybe as a dead guy who's been preserved, and, you know, I will allow for it in Jason Takes Vancouver. But in the 2009, like, he should stink like nothing else in the world stinks. And people stand and do not know that he's standing right behind them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the teleportation thing is an interesting, yeah, in final chapter, you're right. There's a lot of upstairs, downstairs stuff where, you know, that is not a huge house, and he should technically have to walk up and down flights of stairs in front of victims in order for him to get where he is. But this is kind of crazy town, and I just feel like it's a little on the kind of lazy side. And if you're introducing the idea that he can magically appear in front of or behind people and be in two places at once, then why does he bother doing any of the stalking and slashing stuff that he does otherwise? Why does he chase anyone? Like, it's a can of worms. It's a weird... I listened to the commentary, and he talks about how... Rob Hedden talks about how, oh, he can be anywhere. I wanted to say that he can be anywhere. Yes, okay, that's great. But the can of worms on a logistical and kind of filmic level is... Then he shouldn't have to chase anyone, you know?
It wants to have it both ways.
Yeah.
And as a result, you get neither.
Right.
You have to paint a target, otherwise you'll never know where to shoot.
Exactly. And then he strangles her and throws her on the floor.
Yeah, there's three elements I need to bring up here in this particular space. First one is, we learned that this room has fire doors that swing inward, which would...
And then the other doors are locked.
Yes, with a chain. She tries to get into where you would enter the snack bar, but she's in a panic. Secondly, this sequence is apparently filmed by Kenny from Terror Train, because it's all twirling, twirling, twirling.
Oh, yes, yes.
And lastly, is that the whatever record the DJ left on, apparently it's a Joe Satriani record, because it's all guitar solo.
Yes.
For all what feels like 50 minutes of this thing. Now, Jared, you worked with Tobe Hooper.
I did.
And the thing that I love, the signature that I pull from a lot of Tobe's movies, is he gets characters to a point where they simply go mad at the craziness of this.
Yes.
This is how, don't let anyone fool you. You can tell that Poltergeist is a Tobe Hooper movie.
Correct. Thank you.
Because the characters in that movie, immediately, you know, they might gaze off into a light that's just past the camera.
That's right.
But they're also going mad.
That's right.
When they fall into a pool of dead bodies, when a clown tries to strangle them, when they pull another child out of a tree that's trying to eat them.
That's right.
They're like, this is fucking crazy.
That's right.
That's Tobe Hooper.
That's right. When your boss has been lying to you on the street in front of your house. I always say that nobody did crazy like Tobe Hooper. Nobody did crazy like Tobe. And I had many conversations with him about that, because it's something that you go through. I mean, Poltergeist, that you're exactly right. And I have brought up those exact same examples, but you look at the madness in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or the madness in Eaten Alive, or Funhouse, or Texas Chainsaw 2. I mean, it's a palpable thing where he seemed to push actors to these levels that I don't know how he consistently got people to go to that place, but he did, and he did it beautifully.
And such a gentle soul, by all accounts. I never met the man, but...
Yes!
But he seemed to be able to find a way to put that on film, whereas... Now, let's contrast this with what I believe the filmmaker is attempting to do here, where he's put Eva in a room where she has no escape. Lights are going crazy, the dance floor is insane, there's a guitar solo that just won't stop, and this oozing killer is popping... Like he's fucking Jack in the Box or Nightcrawler from the X Men, right, all over the place. And what you want at this is for her to go, you want her to freak the fuck out. And that was the intention, but they never ask her to do anything that relays that. And the movie never builds towards it. And so it's really kind of sad. Gina, any thoughts on Eva's death?
Yeah, her emoting is on a Joan Crawford level when you compare it to that of, what's the next guy? The guy with the hair?
His name? Wayne?
Wayne, yeah. And when you look at how he reacts to discovering JJ's body and, oh, I don't know, accidentally killing a man, he's just... I mean, you know, he's just, yeah, all right, I guess this is something I have to deal with. He seems the mildest of put out.
Some actors, you know, they'll say they act with their eyes or they act with their eyebrows or they act with their mouths. But Kelly Hugh in her death scene is acting with her shoes.
They are cute shoes.
Oh, they're adorable.
Very cute shoes. But the kicking feet is more kind of emotive than what her performance is giving to us. Poor Kelly.
Jason chokes her with both hands.
Yes.
Which, for a guy who we've seen real feats of strength from this individual, he's crushed skulls.
That's right.
He has folded people in half.
Yeah, I mean, her head should be popping off like a Pez dispenser.
It's true.
Exactly. With one hand. He held a guy aloft with a spear gun in his crotch and just held him up in the damn air. He's got that Voorhees family forearm strength.
That's right.
But here, he's just kind of like, eh.
Well, don't forget, he took the stairs. He took the stairs to get here. He's a little winded.
He's like, all of a sudden, he's reduced to Michael Myers, you know, choking as hard.
That's right.
He's been moving couches and boxes all day for his friends. What do you want from him?
So out of breath. I forgot how out of breath this corpse is.
But the real payoff is the incredibly violent hurl to the floor.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. I enjoy those little moments of brutality, as it were, or reality entering into this. But it's so out of place with everything that's happened before it. You have these fantastical setup in this ridiculous room, and then this, like, bloop on the ground, which could have been cool, but...
No, it's weird. It's incredibly strange. It's one of the weirder Friday the 13th death scenes, in my opinion. It's an incredibly strange... Not to mention, you know, the teleportation and the running around the room and then the strangulation with the weird, weird reaction to the strangulation. And then just the heave-ho throwing her onto the dance floor is incredibly strange.
It's just, it's so weird. It's like 2 minutes of screen time, but I could talk about it for another half an hour. I know the audience doesn't
It's fascinating. It's like the shower scene in Psycho. It's absolutely, it deserves to be studied frame by frame. I was so glad that this scene was in amongst the deaths that I got to talk about because it's so utterly fascinating on so many levels. And I mean, there's amazing Steadicam work and clearly like the lighting. I mean, like there is top-notch filmmaking going on here in terms of the personnel, in terms of the people that are actually putting the stuff on the screen. But my God, at the service of what?
I mean, the bar is stocked with alcohol,
right,
which for a high school cruise seems... not the smartest move. But then again, the popcorn maker is not just doesn't just have some popcorn in it. It's filled to the top. You can't make more popcorn because it's literally filled all the way up to the top of it with popcorn. Every part of this is a cavalcade of crazy fucking details.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We just need to stop talking about it. Otherwise, we'll only talk about it. All right. So we cut to Julius, and Julius is doing what he does best, which is take fucking care of business. He has a plan. He has scoured the ship in two locations, game rooms and hallways.
That's right. That's right. Very specific.
Very specific. He's found axes, which are fire axes. They should be found in hallways. He's also found two shotguns. Why they were stored in a game room without a lock on them is a bit much.
It's a very well, very curiously armed cruise ship.
I will stick up for the internal logic of the movie. They did have a skeet shooting scene earlier on the deck of the ship that was established. So I'm okay with the guns. I am with you on what, you know, the idea that they would be there in the first place being very questionable, but they go to these lengths to show both the axes on the walls and the skeet shooting in order to establish that these things are there.
I believe the fact that they weren't locked up.
Oh, absolutely.
It's goofy. Thing that I find a little spurious, yes. But okay. That I'll give him. It can, you know, compare that to the death we just talked about. Like, this is easy straight. This is a minor bump in the road. I'm totally invested in Julius.
Oh, yeah.
He is tough.
Yes.
He is smart. He is proactive. He's everything you could possibly want in a Friday the 13th mm-hmm. character. And he is given almost no respect by this movie whatsoever.
No, I mean, but he is given the best death. Possibly
one of the best moments in the franchise.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if not in the whole series, and definitely in the last couple of movies.
Absolutely.
Yes, it's a standout. That and Sleeping Bag in Part 7 definitely popped to mind. Okay, so they have a plan. They're gonna arm themselves. They're all gonna split up, which is the best way to hunt down a killer.
Of course.
Don't pair up in twos. Go off on your own.
Because who is a more efficient, you know, manhunter than a bunch of high school seniors?
That's right.
From small town rural New Jersey.
Taking a very long voyage to Manhattan.
Having grown up in small town rural New Jersey, I certainly would have trusted my classmates to single-handedly hunt down a living dead creature with the strength of 100 men.
A living creature that this town seems to have a very losing record against.
That's right.
In terms of being able to foil his plans to murder every young person in sight.
It's amazing to me that there are this many young people left. It's also worth pointing out that this is when the movie, and you actually, Patrick, actually pointed this out to me, and it never really dawned on me, this is where it becomes a siege movie.
Mm.
And which is interesting, I've always said that the difference between a slasher and a siege, a slasher movie and a siege movie is awareness. Because in a slasher movie, the usual rule, the usual conceit that you have to try to maintain on a writing level, on a screenplay level, is that nobody can know that the killer is operating, that the killer is doing the deeds, is killing people, because as soon as they know that, then you would take steps. Yeah. You would batten down the hatches, you would get to the authorities, you would do whatever it takes. Now, a siege movie usually is something like Night of the Living Dead or Assault on Precinct 13 or any of those kinds of movies where you know pretty much from the jump that you're in danger, and so you board up the windows and doors and you find whatever weapons you can and you take action against the enemy. And so it's very interesting because it rarely happens in Friday the 13th movies that people take up arms against Jason.
Yeah, it's trying to combine a couple recent trends. And I think that's what we love about reviewing Friday the 13th movies. Very few franchises were built to come out year after year after year with a couple skips here and there. They're reacting very quickly, not only to the last film, but to what else is in the marketplace.
That's right.
So in Part 6, you shift from a stalker slasher, in essence, or an unstoppable killer sort of movie, into a monster movie. He's Godzilla. He's Frankenstein. You just walk into his path and you get destroyed. In Part 7, they take it in a different direction. They pull him back to a stalker slash unstoppable killing machine operation. And then we have a clash of supernatural titans at the end.
Right.
So here, we're trying to have it both ways. We're trying to have this sequence where people are aware of what's happening, but are truly unprepared for the onslaught. And then because this part of the movie was never supposed to exist.
Right. Right.
It was all supposed to be in Manhattan. Then we have this complete shift. Once the boat sinks to back to a different kind of movie, while they are aware they're on the run in an unfriendly city. And that also has, they're trying desperately to be kind of a warriors where they're running from place to place to place, but all they can afford are alleyways.
Right. Well, maybe Gina was onto something, because this is kind of ends now. At this point in this movie, this suddenly is taking a lot of cues from Aliens.
Yeah.
Where they're in the dank hallways and they've got weapons, and you're literally coming up soon. We're going to have Wayne with his camera to his eye while he's got the gun in the other hand, which is very
Aliens. That's a very good point.
I hadn't thought about that. I actually hadn't thought about that, but it's a really, really good point. But what your point about the shift is always interesting to me. A, this is the longest Friday the 13th movie to date. This has the longest running time of any Friday the 13th movie that exists. It is 100 minutes long. Not only does it feel long, but I went to the New Beverly Cinema, ran an 8-movie Friday the 13th all-nighter a couple of years ago, which was incredible, and I went, and you know, they did a Nightmare on Elm Street one, and the prize at the end of that was you got 7 movies, and the prize was New Nightmare, and that was like a great, you know, great way to cap it off. The prize at the end of Friday the 13th, you know, 1 through 8 is Jason Takes Manhattan, which is no prize at all. But when you've been watching 7 movies all night, and you get to part 8, and part 8 is basically like it's almost like 2 movies.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's a 2-part movie where you have the boat stuff. And what we're talking about right now is the beginning of the 3rd act of part 1 of Jason Takes Manhattan, because then a whole other movie starts up. And I will tell you, when you are sleep deprived and you desperately want this to be over, and you've been watching 7 Friday the 13th movies up to this point, the point where this all starts to happen, and it feels like a ramp up to a 3rd act, and then it goes on for another 30 plus minutes in New York with an entirely different kind of premise and style, it's heartbreaking. It really breaks your spirit. It broke my spirit. I got up at one point and just went to the bathroom, just kind of stood in the lobby and saw that the sun had come out and couldn't believe it. It was just one of these moments where it's like, oh God, they're still not there yet. They're still not in New York. But it really does. It's a fascinating structure, and it really does come out of, as Patrick said, it really does come out of this development hell that Jason Takes Manhattan fell in. And it wasn't in development hell, really. It's a wrong statement, the wrong way. It was just development, period. It was very quickly thrown together and made. But his initial draft was they were going to be on the boat for 15 or 20 minutes, and then they were going to get to New York, and it was going to be New York, New York, New York, New York, New York, and Jason doing all this great stuff. And then in the process, they said, well, you can't afford to do all that New York, so you're going to need to do more on the boat. And so the boat stuff just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then you got this weird structure. You have this incredibly strange 2-part structure.
So let's wrap this up with Wayne here. This is a very good observation.
Oh, and Julius has this great line, which is nothing but this gun, by the way, which is, we have to mention.
He pauses.
What are you going to take, Julius?
Almost as if he's aware of the camera.
Yes, no, it's fantastic. we can move on, but I had to get, it's such a great line. It was such a fantastic moment where he's like, you know, the brave guy on the ship. You know, what are you going to take, Julius? Nothing but this gun.
So we cut to Wayne in the bowels of the ship, which we've seen once before with JJ. And yeah, Gina, once again, is always right. We are now stealing from Aliens. So we're stealing from the best here. We've put someone in nothing but greats and also random steam shooters.
Yes. Which is very Aliens.
Yeah, he gets shot, and he takes a thing of steam right in the face and doesn't even, I mean, he turns away and then he's fine. Like, dude, your half your face should be melting off.
Exactly. And why is he carrying his camera?
I think he's using it as he's using the flashlight part of it.
Oh, he's using it.
I thought he was doing some sort of like Cloverfield thing.
Well, I was going to say, it becomes that. It becomes the very first instance of the killers, anyway, of the Michaels and Freddies and Jasons. It is the first found footage moment of the franchises.
Yes. Certainly, I mean, I guess you could so almost then peg it to Aliens because they use body cameras. But that's the feel and the look we're going for. Yeah, he manages to only get his glasses knocked off and not have his eyeballs rupture when hot steam erupts his face.
Yeah, he apparently now I must point out I have very poor vision, but he's legally blind. I mean, he needs like a cup of pencils because he just can render completely and utterly helpless as soon as he loses his glasses.
Yes, and I understand. I actually, you know, it's one of the rare instances in this movie where I actually buy, other than the circumstances, I buy everything that happens. I buy that he would immediately shoot, you know, a human figure that is coming at him when he can't see because he doesn't know how to handle a gun and he shouldn't have one. And he's got a gun in one hand and a video camera in the other. So, and he can't see. So I would totally, I buy it. It's one of the rare instances where there is a human believable emotion, a human believable action being, a reaction being taken where he sees that guy coming and just open fire.
Yeah. The only other really repercussion from him getting blasted in the face with steam is that his hair becomes even more River Phoenix-like.
Yes.
Which I'm sure is what got him cast. Good for him. You got a hell of a head of hair. He shoots this guy in cold fucking blood.
That's right.
And then we begin a very weird... he sees it through the video camera, which he can then focus. Mm-hmm. The problem with this is that instead of just letting the cameraman do it with the light attached, mm-hmm. a third person is moving the light at a different speed with the camera, and it makes it a little weirdly obvious. But this, of course, is what helps us see Kane Hodder slip on the ground as he enters the frame. And when I found that this morning, I was so delighted.
Who put this Vaseline on my shoes?
I mean, why would you need it on the soles of your shoes for crying out loud?
Well, how will he effectively squish?
That's right.
It's true. That's right. Every part of him should squish. He is a reconstituted raisin with bones in it.
Now, he doesn't just shoot, you know, it's not just a guy. It's not, I mean, it's this weird handyman dude that's on the boat.
It's sexy handyman,
yeah. It's sexy handyman who Tamara had eyes for. And yeah. Since Wayne has had eyes for Tamara, there is like a weird little kind of lair to this where he has shot... a competition.
Yes. He's eliminated his competition after the fact.
Yeah, he never found out that Tamara was killed. Only Eva knew that.
That's right.
They only saw themselves on the what is on the other side of the veil.
That's right.
In order to actually get there, however, he blindly just races the fuck away from Jason, which
that's right.
Good move. Listen. Mm-hmm. He doesn't catch Friday the 13th disease. He's like, fuck this, fuck y'all, I'm out. Mm-hmm. And he just runs. Now, he runs down. That's not a good idea, but he doesn't know where the staircases are going. So he just runs to a staircase and heads that way. He manages to trip over the end of a flying V guitar, which probably weighs 3 pounds, but okay.
Mm-hmm.
And finds the body of poor JJ, who has been given a wound that does not necessarily comport to the way we have seen her die. She has a massive hole in her head, which looks like Jason was supposed to stick the end of the flying V into it and sort of jab kill her, not smash her, which is the what we see during that sequence. So it wouldn't be the first time the makeup department didn't talk to the director and they decided, well, we don't have time to film that. Just have them smash it and smash a bag of ketchup and then we're done.
It's kind of surprising that it's as gory as it is because this movie has had, you know, a lot of off screen and avoiding the gore type stuff.
It had you know, someone getting their throat slashed and did not bleed.
Right. No, and it's one of these things. I mean, I'm sure that you guys both kind of caught wind of this, but you know, with the MPAA, with the Friday the 13th, and this is the eighth one, they had been in trouble with the MPAA. They were a target for the MPAA all the way through from part one on. And so the MPAA were just gunning for them. And so I think that Hedden actually was kind of shooting to accommodate, like he had hit the shots of gore and blood that he hoped would be in the version of the movie that he wanted. But then he also kind of shot the kind of tame PG-13 version and then the kind of TV version. Mm-hmm. So that they would have something to fall back on, because one of the problems, I think, with Seven especially, and they maybe this is where, because it was the same production team, maybe they must have told him, like, because Seven had massive cuts done to it where you can't even, there, some of the kills are incomprehensible. You don't actually know what has happened.
Oh, we know.
Yes. And so I think that they must have told Hedden, given him like a tip, like, hey, look, it's going to be a bitch, but can you shoot your kills two and three different ways where they get, you know, less and less bloody and less gory, so that we can try to get away with stuff as much as we can, but you also have these backups. So I'm wondering if the, you know, sideways guitar smash to the head was a, you know, a cover.
True. It's dark enough that you could probably get away. If you color timed it the right way, you'd probably get it past a TV editor. It would work on USA late at night.
Right.
And then you would have a gorier version, hopefully, for theatrical, which we obviously don't really see. So there's an intention, and what we actually see are two different things. But that's movie making. We've expected it at this point, but it must be noted. This is where Jason does not stop down the two levels. He teleports.
That's right.
Right on down to be standing right behind Wayne.
Exactly.
Picks him up and throws him into this electrical panel.
Yes.
Which explodes like the 4th of fucking July. Yes. So whatever Wayne is wearing is particularly
flammable.
Devastating to this mechanical apparatus.
I think they must be kerosene underwear. Because the first thing that goes up, I'm sure you went back and looked at this very closely, the first thing that ignites is his crotch. And I am not lying. I am not making this up or exaggerating. The first thing of Wayne's that bursts into flames is his crotch.
I can believe it.
Yep.
Based on the way he's talked about Tamara, I think he has held on to a lot of things up to this point. And really, it's a miracle that he hasn't met anything flammable at that level. Because whatever it was going to be, it was going to cause a real explosion.
But let's face it, that panel was a death trap.
It really was. I mean, all it took was a body. Just come, like, not even a full body slam.
No.
He was tossed over there.
Yes. And he's a skinny dude. He's a skinny dude. He does not weigh, 200 pounds. He is a skinny, skinny guy.
So basically, the ship has wanted to commit suicide and is using the death of this 18-year-old River Phoenix lookalike to go, oh, God damn it, you gave me the excuse. Let's do this thing.
Who, by the way, is like a super-duper hipster by today's standards.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
So it's without question, yeah.
He's the nerdy kind of guy that isn't going to get any girls in this movie. And at looking at it in 2017, he is what a hot guy that would be like a babe magnet it would look like at a party right now.
If he was walking around Silver Lake or Brooklyn, he would be getting it left and right from all comers. He would be pansexualing it up. He would make that work for him.
But instead, he had to die horribly on a control panel that clearly had, you know, one small frayed wire in it that was going to cause a huge explosion whenever anybody leaned on it too hard.
Well, he shouldn't have had a flammable crotch.
It's true.
It's the more you know.
The
rainbow stars.
Half the battle.
And yeah, that's the Lazarus is like, you know what? Thank God you put that electrical panel next to my fuel tank. Let's blow up.
Yes, then we get all the shots of the fuel tanks and the huge immolation, just this gigantic fire.
I mean, that's a really good dummy.
Yeah.
Compared to we saw a head in part 7 that we were pretty sure was created out of used baloney.
Ah, yes. Probably was.
And this is so much better.
Yes.
Like, they just
It doesn't suffer burns, which is interesting to me. Like they have that one long, kind of, it's a little too long, shot of the body burning, and they establish that they pan over slowly, and they establish that the fuel stuff is there, the fuel tanks are there.
Film is not filled with pans over quickly.
His flesh on his face is completely unblemished. It is not there. He has suffered no burns, even though he's dead and burning. But it's a great dummy, though. It's a fantastic looking dummy.
Fire requires oxygen. He's nearly poreless, so oxygen can't get in.
Oh, there you go.
He can't light on fire.
There you go.
You had it. And I whammied you. And so then, and that sadly brings us to the part of this podcast that everyone is talking about constantly to themselves, not to anyone else, ever. Never on social media, not anywhere else. And that is Choose Your Own Death Venture. Now, we're gonna decide amongst the deaths that we witnessed in our section of the movie for this episode, if we had to die one of those ways, which one we would choose and why. And to review, we have getting tossed on an electrical panel and having your crotch explode, getting shot by an 18-year-old high school graduate who can't see, or being choked to death in a disco snack bar. And Jared Rivet, as our guest, I turn to you first. What say you, sir?
I would have to say that it would be the flaming crotch control panel fire, because I just think that is, if you're going to go out in a blaze of glory, that is literally the blaze that I want to be in.
I mean, look at the head of hair on that.
Yeah.
Kid. Who wouldn't want to go out with that head of hair? Like, you came out on top.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's what, you know, I mean, you look at the Kelly Hugh and you say, like, well, there's kind of a weak strangulation, acting with the feet thrown on the floor. No. And for me, it's about the flaming crotch.
Everyone in this sequence is going to have a hard landing. If you're looking for a soft landing, this was the wrong section of the movie to view. So I think that's a perfectly legitimate choice. All right, Gina, what is your choice?
I probably weighed this more than I usually weigh this decision on other episodes. The first thing I kept coming back to is like Wayne, I have a Milhouse level of vision. I would like to think I would recognize the difference between, you know, a crew member and a hulking undead serial killer. And yet I don't want to be electrocuted. That seems like an unpleasant way to die. And also I can absolutely see me accidentally getting shot by someone who has lost his glasses when he takes a blast of steam to the face. So I am going to have to take, I'm going to take sexy crew member's way out.
Yeah, Gina, you've convinced me. There's no way I'm going out in a snack bar listening to guitar solo rock. It's not going to happen. Secondly, I really love aliens, so that seems like a gimme. And a shot to the gut, even if you're suffering, like, that boat's about to explode in the next 5 minutes. So we don't really know for sure that he could just be in shock in that moment and really dies when the boat goes under. So, yeah, I'm going with sexy crew member.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
That does it. Okay, so Jared, where can people find you, and where can people find the things that you've done?
Okay, I am on Twitter. I think I'm just at JaredRivet1, because that was what was available when I went on Twitter. I have written, my first produced feature film is called Jackals, and Jackals, it was directed by Kevin Greudert, the director of Saw 6 and Saw the Final Chapter. It has stars Jonathan Scheck and Deborah Kara Unger and Stephen Dorff, and it is available just about any way that you can get stuff at this point. It's not on Netflix, but it's like everything else where you can rent or buy. So Redbox and Vudu and Amazon, you know, to rent on Amazon and on demand. And it's on Blu-ray and DVD from Scream Factory, the good people at Scream Factory. And I am extremely proud of the movie. It's a good cult siege horror movie. And you can look for that on Jackal's Movie on Twitter, at Jackal's Movie, and also on Facebook. I think it's Jackal's Movie. As Patrick knows, I am the co-host of Dead Right Horror Trivia, which is a monthly horror trivia game that, unfortunately, you have to be local. It's not something, there's no online version or anything. But it's at Blast from the Past in Burbank every third Thursday of the month. And I've been doing that for 2 years now, but I've been playing the game since the beginning, which I think is like 5 or 6 years now at this point. And then I also write and direct and act in pod plays, scary radio dramas for the internet for a company called Earbud Theater. And they are earbudtheater.com. They are at Earbud Theater on Twitter, and they're also on Facebook under Earbud Theater. And those are great. Those are really cool, kind of old school, scary radio shows with really high production values. And we get industry people to come in and do the sound mixes and the sound effects, and we get great actors to come in. And we just did a 5-part, the first serialized story on Earbud. Most of it is kind of Twilight Zone-y anthology kind of stuff where they're one-offs, but we just did a 5-part story called After the Haunting, which I play the lead in. I didn't write it or direct it, but I got to play the lead in it, and it's doing extremely well, and I want more people to listen to it.
All right, get out there, people. I can't recommend Jackals enough. You got a prime Stephen Dorff performance.
Oh, he's actually so good.
Trying.
Yes, yes.
It's not lazy Stephen Dorff. You get full Dorff.
The full Dorff.
He must have been vaping up a full stack.
He was.
To have all the energy that movie.
I was going to say, he's given it that blue e-cigs treatment.
He had
really putting himself
out
there.
He had one of those in his pocket the entire time we were making the movie. I'm not kidding you. But he was great. He was great. And he's actually really strong in the movie. Like I
agree.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I thought it might be too familiar, but there are some twists in there that should not be ruined for you before you see it.
No.
Just go in cold.
Yes.
And know that Scream Factory does not put out terrible movies.
No.
They only put out good to great movies.
Thank you.
And I liked it quite a bit. Hey, Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, after all that, I feel a little bit inadequate when I say that I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com. As of this recording, I am diving deep into the sordid world of all three Amy Fisher movies.
Ooh. Whoa, including the Alyssa Milano one, I assume.
That is next. That's going to be next week.
Oh, that's beautiful. I have to listen.
Do it today, people. Hey, you want to talk to us at the Kill by Kill podcast? There's a couple easy ways to do it. Very simple on Twitter, at Kill by Kill Pod. You have something longer than 140 to 280 characters, which the 280 only seems to be given to the worst people on the planet that we've seen so far. Or they're the only ones who dare to use it. Couldn't tell you. But email us, killbykillpod@gmail.com. We're on Instagram, killbykillpodcast. We do fun things over there. Check us out. Hey, you love the podcast. You're listening to it. So why not let iTunes know about it? That will help us grow. And if you tell us what your favorite Friday the 13th kill is of all time, we will tell it to the world on this podcast. That's our solemn promise to you, the Kill by Kill podcast listener. Oh, don't be afraid, people. The body count will continue. Until next time, for Jared and for Gina and myself, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.